Up in the morning and out to school. The teacher is teaching the golden rule. American history and practical math. Studying the hard and hoping to pass. Working your fingers right down to the bone. And the guy behind you won't leave you alone. Ring, ring, goes the bell. The suck of my mouth, you better sell. You're lucky if you can find a seat. You're fortunate.
My name is Carol Burris, and I'm the Executive Director of the Network for Public Education, based right here in New York City. And this is Talk Out of School, a show where we focus on issues affecting public schools here in New York City, the state, and nationally. And we want you to enter the dialogue, too. So be sure to call in at the 10:30 break at 212-209-2877. Again, that is 212-209-2877. Well, listeners, spring is just around the corner, and that means here comes 3-8 Common Core testing in our schools. Hey, you know, I'm old enough to remember when there were just tests in elementary school, state tests in grades 4 and 8. They were reasonable, they were short, and they let you know which kids might need help. And then, as you probably remember, along came billionaire Merrill Tisch and Commissioner John King and Arne Duncan and raced to the top, and we got stuck with a Common Core nightmare. Well, today's guests, Jeanette Duderman and Lisa Rudley, waged a full-fledged rebellion on those Common Core tests. And they are here today to talk to me about that, as well as the new book that they co-authored. They're going to let us know what's happening with the opt-out movement in New York. But before we get to Lisa and Jeanette, I have another important guest who is going to talk about an important event that will be happening in New York City next week on February 13th, and that is William Doyle. William Doyle is the co-author with Posse Salberg of Let the Children Play, How More Play Will Save Our Schools and Help Children Thrive. He is a New York Times best-selling author and a TV producer based right here in New York City also. Since 2015, he's served as a Fulbright Scholar and advisor to the Ministry of Education of Finland. He has a child who's a sixth grader right here in a public school in New York City. Good morning, William. How are you?
Good morning, Carol. It's great to talk to you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming on. So can you tell our listeners what's going to be happening on February 13th?
Yes. Well, we have a terrific event at the Finnish Consulate in Midtown, New York at 605 Third Avenue. It's a book launch for Let the Children Play, and my co-presenter will be Dr. Michael Hines, the superintendent of schools for the Port Washington School District, who we feature in our book, showcasing his radically effective and new approach to providing much more play and physical activity to children in public schools. So it'll be a discussion with him and I. We are sold out at the moment, but if you go to Eventbrite and just look up the event, William Doyle and Michael Hines, there's a list, and they'll let you know when people drop off the list. So that's what it's going to focus on, our book, Let the Children Play, which is really a global look at play all around the world. And you know what's really kind of exciting is we think, Posse Salberg and I, think that the world is poised for kind of a global reawakening and renaissance and rediscovery of this critical piece of education that we have demolished and forgotten in largely in America. And if we restore play to schools, physical activity, choice, breaks, freedom, and take the jackboot of standardized testing off the throat of our students, our children, and our teachers, we think that we can really start to turn the system around and really start to flourish, which, as you know better than anybody, 20 years of so-called education reform right. or destruction really has not achieved.
Yeah. You know what? Can you expand on that concept just a little bit? Because, you know, I know you well enough to know that you're not saying, gee, kids shouldn't be learning in schools and there's no place for literacy or mathematics. So if you could, you know, we don't want to have any of our listeners say, oh, don't want to hear that. I don't want my kid going to school to play all the time. Right. So talk a little bit more about the research behind what you're going to be talking about.
Sure. Well, I was a New York City father, a dad, a playground dad. And I, long story short, I heard that Finland had the so-called most effective schools. I was told that by the great Howard Gardner at Harvard University. And I thought, what are you talking about? And I fell down the rabbit hole and wound up falling in love with Finland schools from afar. And I moved my family there, actually, to the Russian border. To the Russian border, no less.
Wow.
To their largest teacher training university, and I pushed myself into the fly on the wall there, on and off for the last 4 years. And what I found is that Finland schools are like American schools could be to a certain extent. There are
right.
big cultural differences, of course, but you know what they do is they do they have very highly trained teachers that teach. They are selected, respected, and trained like elite professionals, as you were.
Mm-hmm.
And so the point is that they have a wonderful system of teacher training. They don't have standardized testing, but the day is broken up with concentrated learning, real learning, hands-on, labs. Wood shop, metal shop, second language, a lot of the things that we've forgotten here in the United States. And then the children are given breaks every hour.
Yeah.
And it turns out, Carol, that that's precisely what the American Academy of Pediatrics has been pleading for the last several years with some critical reports they've issued. This is an American pediatric recommendation. We don't do it. It's like ignoring, you know, vaccination or breastfeeding or car seat advice by
right.
doctors because they see the impact of it. So think of it as the ultimate pediatric and educator-driven idea. The idea simply is to break up the day with periods of much more moving around and physical activity and some choice time and some passion projects and breaks. Children desperately need this. But we have this culture of, you know, forced physical restraint and testing, which kind of, it miswires the entire system of childhood education.
You know, it's very interesting because I had three daughters, right? My husband and I, and now with grandkids, you know, I have mixed genders, right? One granddaughter, another granddaughter on the way, and then three boys in the middle. And I'm looking at these boys who are just so bright. They're so high energy. I'm like, no way. No way would they be able to, you know, sit still. And, you know, and look, kids are all different, and I don't mean to gender stereotype, but I have a feeling that there's probably a little bit of research behind that.
There is a tidal wave of research in the Institute of Medicine, Centers for Disease Control, randomized controlled experiments. Right now, Carol, in Oklahoma, Texas, Montgomery County, Maryland, and Long Island, there are schools that are experimenting with giving children much more physical activity during the day. And guess what happens? They get more focused, behavior problems go down, and children love coming to school. Now, my child's first day in a Finnish public school,
right.
I could not drag him out of the school. He said, no, I want to stay here. And I said, well, the building's going to be empty. What happened to you today? And he said, it's just so much fun. And that meant not only playing at age eight, but it meant the attitude of the teachers. Because they have the freedom to fail and experiment and thrive along with the children. And that's an attitude that we've forgotten in the United States. And, you know, one day we were walking along the woods. It was dark and cold and snowy, as it usually is in Finland in the winter, and the lights of the school came into view, and he said, you know something? Every kid should have a school like this, because he felt like home
to
him.
Great.
And that's what we've got to do with our schools. Schools should be a child's favorite place. We can do that, and we should.
I absolutely agree with you, and I'm really delighted to let our listeners know that on March 11th, you're going to come back. You're going to be my guest again. I can't wait. You'll be joined by Mike Hines, and best of luck to you on the 13th. And, boy, folks, get yourself on that waiting list. You know, plans change. It's flu season. This is someone that you desperately want to listen to. I am sure of it. And now, thank you, William. We're going to go to a very short break, and then we'll be joined by our next guests, Jeanette Dudeman and Lisa Rudley of Opt Out.
Hello there, my faithful WBAI listeners. This is Hazel Pinder, a member of WBAI's local station board, and I have some information to share with you. The next meeting of the local station board is on Wednesday, February 12th at 7 p.m. The location is at the YWCA at 33rd Avenue, Brooklyn, New York, between Atlantic Avenue and State Street. At the last WBAI local station board meeting, a resolution was adopted which condemned proposed changes to the Pacific Foundation's bylaws. These changes in the bylaws were an attempt at an anti-democratic restructuring of Pacifica, which would eliminate local broadcasting like over WBAI. We on the local station board voted unanimously against adopting the proposed bylaw amendments. Meetings of the local station board are open to the public, and as always, there will be an opportunity for public comment. The meeting is wheelchair accessible. Join us. Again, that's Wednesday, February 12th at 7 p.m. at the YWCA, 33rd Avenue, Brooklyn, New York. Listeners and the public are invited and welcome. It's your radio station. Please come out and voice your opinion.
Thanks to you.
And while he's thanking those folks, let me take this opportunity to thank all of you, our listeners and support staff, our contributors, our interns, the volunteers, producers, and the entire crew that works countless hours to bring WBAI into your lives.
Thank you, people. We've got our friends at CNN here. You guys love breaking news, and you did it. You broke it. I think what no one in this room wants to admit is that Trump has helped all of you. He couldn't sell steaks or vodka or water or college or ties or Eric, but he has helped you. He's helped you sell your papers and your books and your TV. You helped create this monster, and now you're profiting off of him.
We're with you, Michelle Wolf, but if corporate media has got you down, maybe you should try WBAI. We're listener-supported community radio, questioning the mainstream narratives trumpeted by the news profiteers. But in order for this whole thing to work, we need your help. Please go to give2wbai.org to find out how you can support WBAI or call 516-620-3602. And thanks for supporting Free Speech Radio on WBAI New York.
Hi, this is Carol Burris, and I'm back with Talk Out of School. Next up, we have two women who rocked the foundation of the New York State testing world. They even had Governor Cuomo on the run for a while. In fact, I think he was on speed dial on one of their phones. You know, these two women, Jeanette Dudeman and Lisa Rudley, started the biggest and strongest opt-out movement in the United States, and the tests have never recovered. Before we begin our conversation, I'd like to tell our listeners a little bit about them. Lisa is the executive director of the New York State Allies for Public Education. It's an organization known as NYSAPE. NYSAPE led the historic opt-out movement, coordinating close to a quarter of a million parents to opt their children out of the New York State's tests annually since 2015. She's a fierce advocate of preserving and strengthening public education. Lisa has made an impact on education legislation and regulations across New York State. She currently serves as the president of the Ossining Board of Education. Jeanette is a founder of Long Island Opt Out, as well as a co-founder of NYSAPE. Over the past 7 years, Jeanette has advocated for the removal of Common Core curriculum in our schools and high-stakes testing in our children's classrooms. She's advocated against the defunding and privatization of our public schools, and she deeply believes in the concept of whole child teaching and bringing kids once again to learning as the center of their education. Lisa and Jeanette were two of four authors of a recently released book, Opting Out, the Story of the Parents' Grassroots Movement to Achieve Whole Child Public Schools. Welcome, Lisa and Jeanette.
Hi, Carol.
Thank you. Thank you for having us, Carol.
Oh, we are just so thrilled to have you here. You know, I'm wondering if you could start off by telling our audience about how and when that opt-out movement began. It's such a great story.
Lisa. This is Lisa Rudley. And again, thanks for having us, Carol. We started in around 2013 when parents started seeing their students, children coming home very concerned about what was going on in the classrooms. I came at it from the aspect of the data collection that was starting to happen. And as my own children were coming home very concerned about what was happening in the classrooms, everything became higher stakes. The teaching was shifting, the prepping was shifting, because Race to the Top had come upon us, and we were preparing our students in the classrooms to take these tests. So I have a child that was receiving special education services, and that was a double whammy for him. So we all began looking at ways in which we could opt out our children. We all came together, a group of leaders across New York State, connected in Syracuse, New York, in the summer of 2013 to establish New York State Allies for Public Education and to coordinate everybody around the state that was already looking at this issue to begin what Carol, you just shared, one of the biggest historic opt-out movements in the country.
Yeah, Jeanette, I'm wondering if you could piggyback a little bit, because I know a lot of your organization on Long Island, I was a principal there at the time, was really around a Facebook page, right?
Yeah, as when I started to, this came organically. It wasn't that I learned about things in the government and the schools and all that, and then I looked at my kid and said, oh, wait, is this affecting you? It was the opposite. It was seeing changes in my kids and how they were relating to school, hearing teachers talking differently about things, parents on the playground really starting to voice concerns. And again, no one really understood. You know, we were just parents. Nobody fully understood what suddenly had shifted inside those classrooms, because it was a very dramatic and very fast shift. We say it's the perfect storm. Everything came in all at once. So it wasn't this gradual change. It was very obvious. So it was seeing the changes in the children that then caused me to start looking into what, and we went, you know, it wasn't just, oh, I immediately looked at to see what was going on with the testing. It was going through all the normal things. Is there problems with friends at school? Is there an issue with the teacher? And then narrowing things down and listening to other parents, which I, you know, it's just, I guess, in my nature to really want to get to the bottom of what exactly the situation was, and then discovering what had been changing in that classroom and hearing from teachers and being appalled by what I had heard. And we had, you know, me and a group of the parents that were all talking about, like, once we started learning about this, I felt this intense need to make sure other parents also knew what was happening, because it felt like a almost a little whistleblower-ish, like, oh, my God, I figured this out. How the heck am I going to get other parents to also understand? And Facebook, you know, I wasn't a huge Facebook user. I dabbled in it a little bit, but it wasn't like a really big thing for me. But it just seemed like a great way to be able to suddenly get this, you know, post things and get this information out there. And it grew so fast. And we realized this is a great way to have everybody join in the discussion and get this information without, you know, without funding, without having to put a huge amount of resources behind it. We could still share all this information.
Right. And so then you got to a point, as both NYSEP and as Long Island Opt Out, where you had a strategy, right? It was going to be the way to stop this was to opt out of the tests. So can the both of you talk a little bit about what that means, especially in the early days, right? Because I'm sure that you got pushback on this.
Yeah, this was not as in the early days, the first round of parents that really, used this as their, you know, parents that did see the same thing as I did, which this was negatively impacting our children, and said, well, what's unique about the opt-out movement, it's not just about here's what's wrong. It was offering a solution, too. It was saying there's something you can actually do about this. And it's, you know, I wouldn't say super easy, but it yet easy enough that we're going to give you the tools and the language to use. Mm-hmm. And we have a letter for you to have. And it's basically going around teaching parents how to advocate and handing them the resources for that, which was really essentially as simple as a letter, but then helping parents also navigate what to do when they do face resistance. And we had toolkits, and we have, which we still do, here's what you do in this scenario. Here's what you do in this scenario. If your administrator says this to you, here's what you do then. So it was like a step-by-step guide. The other crucial piece of increasing numbers was not just, we realized Facebook, you know, you can get a lot of people on board through Facebook, but it only goes so far because, you know, a lot of people like to just see things quick and scroll through. We realized that doing forums was really going to be key.
Right.
So then we started, you know, going, and it was almost like a teaching, you know, tool where you would go to a forum, parents would show up, and you would go step by step through how they can do this, what they should do. They would be able to ask questions, you know, and we would help them navigate this whole system.
So, yeah. You know, I think that some of our listeners might be asking, well, maybe you could talk about this, Lisa. Well, why can't I just, like, keep my kids home during the week of the tests? And why do I need to actively opt them out?
I want to just add one piece of why we were able to opt out when we felt it was within our right. There was a technical code when you opt out of or refuse the test. It was a code that administrators would use if a student in middle school, let's say, did not want to take the test. So it was this code 999, which was very significant because that gave students and parents and administrators the ability to write that on the student's test that opted out. So that was a real significant point because it really gave everybody legs to stand on. And the state education department really couldn't do anything about it because it was in their rules. So that was really interesting that we were able to research that and utilize that as a starting point in some areas. So in terms of keeping your children home, I mean, really the point was the whole idea was so our children would have, classroom time with their teachers to be learning the subjects that we wanted them to. So, but we also wanted these children to be visible. There were a lot of parents at work that can't have their children at home. But the important thing was for children to show, you know, for our children, their public education, to be able to show up to school. And as we opted out, school districts actually, some, not all, were very understanding. They would either allow the child to sit, you know, in a children to sit in separate rooms and read, But unfortunately, we had a lot of districts where schools would require the children to sit and stare, which mm-hmm. was really just, we made us face another issue that was going on within the schools. And this only empowered us to say, wait a second, where's the dignity for all students? But I also want to go way back to the early 2000s when a school district in Westchester County, Scarsdale, New York, I want to give them credit when No Child Left Behind started, and there was going to be testing third to eighth grade in each grade now, and that was a lot more than just the fourth and eighth grade tests. They decided to take the eighth grade students out. So parents got together and would carpool by having their students show up for school, take attendance, then they would pick them up and then bring them back after the test. So they should also be, they would be able to have an attendance
right.
Recorded as they were there. So that was really significant too. And we did some of that as well, where parents would drop their children off, they would sign in, and then they would pick them back up and then drop them off after the test. So there were a lot of different things that we were having to do. But attendance was also an issue for a lot of parents and children. There were so many days of the testing. We didn't want our children to miss school.
Right. And I think there's also another complication, if I remember well, and that is if your student is absent on the day of the test, then the school has a right when they come back to make them make up the test, which means then you would be stuck in a cycle of pulling your kids out, or is that not true?
Yeah, no.
That is true. I'll let Jeanette take that one.
Yeah. There is one thing that's great about the state tests is that they are on very specific days and very specific times. So we know exactly when they're being administered and exactly what time. And there's also, rules around that if a child leaves like right once the test starts to become administered, you can't come back in the room, and then test on that same test. So there's the rules around administration, the strict rules around it, actually worked in our favor because we were then able to navigate around those rules. And if a child was out and an administrator really wanted to be vindictive, technically, even if they knew they were trying to opt out, we had a couple of cases where administrators would then use that as an opportunity to, when the student came back into the school, they would take them and try to test them, or we had one administrator that really went off the rails a little bit, and they would actually have the kids make up sit and stare time. So even though they knew they were opting out, when the child came back to school, they would sit them in a room and make them, while the class is moving on, the child would have to sit for 3 hours and do nothing because they didn't want them getting away with, missing out on that sit and stare time. It really certainly separated the school officials that truly had the interests of the children, first and foremost, and the ones that really it became sort of a power struggle.
Yeah.
And those are the ones that we really had to use. We used all sorts of tactics. We had to use the media. That was a real key ally for us because, the media was paying very close attention to all this. So we would alert them to a situation like that, and they would literally show up at a school with cameras, and we would have parents, meet them outside and interview them. And, so we were able to figure out a way to really make this, make this a situation that that we were able to successfully help parents in their advocacy efforts.
Right. Well, we're going to take just a short break now. Lisa and Jeanette, you need to stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment. We're going to talk some more about opt-out with Lisa and Jeanette. And we want you, our listeners, to enter the dialogue. Call us up. Ask questions about opt-out. I'm telling you, these ladies are the experts. Be sure to call in at the break. And that number is 212-209-2877. Once again, 212-209-2877.
Ten $10 a month. It's the price of a gigabyte of data for that iPad you never use. It's two overpriced coffees you ordered when you forgot to look at the menu. It's your overzealous attempts to meet the credit card minimum at the bodega on the corner. But $10 a month could be a lot more. Become a BAI buddy and commit to a recurring monthly donation to WBAI. This money will help us continue to broadcast the thoughts and perspectives of the progressive public. A BAI buddy is also not without perks. Your monthly contribution will earn you a WBAI tote bag and a member card offering Zipcar sales, discounted meals at select restaurants, and a handful of other benefits. You will also become a full voting member of WBAI, and our diverse programming will reflect your voice. Go to givetowbai.org and become a BAI buddy to support Free Speech Radio today.
We're in a unique moment here. It's a moment where we have a chance to actually demonstrate our power.
Imhotep Gary Bird heard on WBAI Friday evenings from 7 to 9 p.m.
I learned from Dr. Walter Fauntroy, who fought with Dr. King in the Civil Rights Movement, that there were five areas that they identified that they felt politics could control and hit. It was health, housing, education, economics, and social justice. The fact is, WBAI is a nexus for the progressive community to make those changes in all of those areas and has been decade after decade. I say to you again, whose station?
Our station!
Whose control?
Our control!
Long live WBAI.
This is listener-sponsored, locally controlled WBAI New York.
This is Carol Burris, and we're back with Talking Out of School, and you bet we are lovers of WBAI, listener-sponsored radio. And boy, we sure would love it if you would sign up online to be a BAI buddy for our program, Talk Out of School. So we're back now with our two guests, Lisa Rudley and Jeanette Duderman, the mighty women of Opt Out. And before we kind of move into the present and some of the challenges that parents are facing today, I'm wondering if you could talk just a little bit about some of the other stuff that got tied into those tests and how you think that affected the opt-out movement, both inhibited it and also helped it expand. And one of those issues was the evaluation of teachers by test scores.
I want to say, it really was the perfect storm. The APPR, the evaluation of teachers, the amount that the test, and we can thank Governor Cuomo for this, and I say that sarcastically, 50% of a teacher and principals or teachers' evaluation was going to be based on the standard, was based on the standardized test. And it really just shifted everything, as well as that the new Common Core standards were now tied to the tests, and the Common Core standards were developmentally inappropriate, and we can go into a whole hour about that as well. But the real, one of the big drivers was it shifted the way classrooms were, elementary school, eight-year-olds were being taught. And that pressure was unbelievable. And not only the pressures for the teachers and the principals, but for the school buildings themselves. And so it created this, it went the opposite way of what the evidence shows in terms of teaching and learning. And it really revved up these classrooms to not look like classrooms, but to look like test prep factories. And it was such a shift overnight. And everybody should know that's listening today that New York State had already been increasing the duration of the test, the time that it was almost three times the amount of the testing time from when it was in the 90s. I mean, the students were sitting for 3 hours a day for 3 days. So on top of all of this, the tests were really being driven. There was so much emphasis on it. It really shifted everything. And the standards were new. And the standards were way above the, you know, not the intelligence of our brilliant students, but the appropriateness level. And that really shifted everything. And it was such a mess. And I have to, I just want to say I'm so grateful for all the parents and students and community members out there working side by side with all of us to really say this is enough is enough.
Yeah, I mean, I can remember how intense it was because you had a situation where the evaluation of teachers were taken out of the hands of districts and essentially mechanized, right, with the test scores. And it was such a cynical, and there are still test score, by the way, listeners, there are still test scores and teacher evaluations today, but this was extraordinarily cynical. This was a New York State Education Department, and also, you know, nationally with Race to the Top, with this belief that the teachers were lazy, right? Teachers were lazy, principals were lazy, and if we threatened them with their jobs, they would finally do their jobs, and they would get those kids to learn, and we would see it in test scores. And that really was the driver behind all of this. And what's the state of all of that today? I mean, if you could just give our listeners an update. Are test scores still being used? Which ones are being used? And then what about the Common Core? Did the Common Core disappear?
Yeah, so as far as Common Core, New York State and most states in the country, there was such a backlash over Common Core. Most states can't even use the word Common Core anymore. It gets everyone going. It was a completely failed experiment. But unfortunately, what had happened, Common Core was heavily tied into money, of course, and it was all the, you know, basically every school threw out all their textbooks and ordered all new materials that were all aligned to Common Core. And, you know, one red flag is what we're going to see now as all the states change to newly named standards. You'll notice that the materials are probably not going to change a whole lot, which should key everybody into the fact that not much will change except for the name in most cases. Even New York, I think it was about 5% of the standards, you know, actual changes to the standards. When State Ed was putting out their percentages of how much has changed, they were counting, like, whether they change punctuation in the details of the standards and how they wrote the standard. So the standard itself is still essentially the same. They just changed a couple of the little, you know, details, and now suddenly, oh well, that's a new standard, even though it's essentially the same. So unfortunately, we still will see standards that are wildly inappropriate for certain grade levels, and we're not going to see that much improvement in that area. So what we still need to do is work towards, you know, that's still on our list of things that we
right.
need to continue to advocate for. You know, when we talk about, you know, why we're doing what we're doing and why do we still opt out? Why are we still, like, in this fight? You know, a lot of us that started this movement, our kids are now, my younger son is in his last year of opting out. So as of next year, I no longer have to submit an opt-out letter, and there's many parents, many leaders for the opt-out movement that are in the same boat where our kids are aging out of this opt-out process. But the reason we're still involved is because this became much more. It became more than just, oh, opt out of the test. There is so much background that is going on. This
right.
involves state politics, federal politics, money, power, inequity,
right.
Privatizing. And what we realized in the early days, yes, it was very, very much, that first year was very much about, this is hurting our kids, let's protect them that day. You know, those 2 weeks of testing, let's protect them. Then as we went through and as the numbers grew, we realized that those numbers were equating to having seats at every table. We were then being called by politicians. We were being asked to, you know, support politicians that were running for office that then wanted to take up our education, you know, platforms.
Right.
And we realized that we were on to something more than just, oh, protect my kid for this test. We became advocates for all kids, for all public schools, and how can we strengthen public schools, you know, protect against the onslaught of corporate money that was, you know, there is so much money in public education that is, that these corporations feel is up for grabs.
Yeah.
And it is something they look at with, like, you know, dollar signs in their eyes of how can we get our hands on this? And, you know, this whole, all of the testing and curriculum and race to the top and ESSA, all of this has to do with where the money is distributed, how corporations can get their hands on it. You cannot take over a school with a charter unless you prove it's failing. How do you prove it's failing? We put a blanket across the nation, say everybody has to meet this at the same time, in the same way, in the same place, and then we can now rank everybody and sort them and say, you're failing, you're fine, you're this, you're that.
Right.
And now you have a system that is set up to take over in public schools.
I want to go ahead and open the phone lines in just a minute, but and I have to have you guys back on when we get closer to the tests themselves. But if you could just, one of you could just very, very quickly talk a little bit about the legislation that's being sponsored by Senator Robert Jackson and Assemblyman Harvey Epstein.
Yes, go ahead, Lee. So, and I just want to say that the way the evaluations, it's still based on, teacher evaluations are still based on 50% test scores.
Right.
And now the shift of the legislation basically says there are state-approved local assessments that can be negotiated locally, but there's an option if school districts want to, is to use the state test. So they're still able to be used if a school district and the teachers decide to. This bill, Senator Robert Jackson, amazing. He's been an amazing advocate, part of Campaign for Fiscal Equity around New York State and a historic case in winning foundation aid for the state yet to be fully paid out. And his colleague in the Assembly, Assembly Member Harvey Epstein, are sponsoring a bill that essentially codifies a parent's right to opt out. We do have the right to opt out. The chancellor and commissioner last year sent out a formal statement about it. But still, we believe and the community believes that we need legislation to actually codify it. And the Senate, it's Senate number 5394 and Assembly number A7744. If anybody's jotting that down, and we can always give you information on it. But I think this is really important because this creates equity across all schools to allow parents to opt their students out, their children out. And this really is a civil rights issue because the inequities that parents and students and children face in schools is real. And this will codify our right to opt out.
That is great. I mean, that is certainly legislation that that we hope everybody supports. I'm going to give that phone number again. If you have a question, call in. And until people call in, we'll just keep on chatting about it. I think you're doing such a good job explaining all of this. Nobody has a question. So, but if you do have a question or a concern, the number is 212-209-2877. Now, going back to opt out and the ability to opt out, as I remember it, and it may have shifted since I left the public school world, the majority of the opt outs seem to be happening on Long Island and in the suburbs. And in the largest district, which is New York City, where we're based, there were not many opt outs. Now, I'm wondering if the two of you could talk a little bit about that. Why do you think there are fewer opt-outs in the city? What is it that is unique about New York City that makes parents hesitate?
Yeah, so with the new ESSA legislation, so ESSA is a federal law that still requires 3-8 testing. And it when we had to renew New York State, no, I won't get into the weeds on this, but basically, we had to come up with a plan to comply with ESSA. And what New York State did, unfortunately, we were still under the leadership of Mary Ellen Elia in state ed, who very much supported high-stakes testing. And, you know, we were advocating, and many people were advocating, to take some of the emphasis off of testing and start looking at, we put out something called the Opportunity to Learn Index, which is we wanted schools ranked, sorted, and rated based on the opportunities they're giving to their students rather than what a test score was telling us, because we know test scores generally measure income levels and right. not how well a school is. You know, there's things like surveys where, you know, schools that had low test scores, but yet parents were all still saying they loved their public school. So we wanted to have a way to show that difference. So unfortunately, New York State still went in the direction of primarily looking at test scores as the measure of whether a school is doing well or not. So because of that, we still have major fear in schools about worrying about whether they'll be put on a list that says that they're not doing well, that says that they're failing. This fear each year ramps up somehow more and more, and that is one of the things that we have to deal with for opt-out, because now participation rate, the way that they calculate that, has changed for schools. Instead of just calculating how the students that took the test did, now they're also averaging in, when they divide that, they're adding into the denominator all the kids that potentially could have taken the test. So meaning that kids who did not take the test don't earn credit for the school when they average those scores in. The students themselves don't get a score, but it still counts against the school in the final average. So that has
caused I think the difference, too, and just to add to Jeanette, is in New York City, they're structured. They have mayoral control.
Right.
So it's one big school board. They have middle school and high school admissions that depend on the test scores. And so I'm almost amazed, and we were at the Robert Jackson and Assemblymember Epstein's forum last week about this legislation. I'm amazed even they had 3% opt-out, and that's about a million eligible students in New York City opt-out because of the high-stakes nature of getting into middle school and high school. And quite frankly, you know, the UFT, which is a branch of NYSET, they're concerned. The issue that was always raised is that they didn't have this teachers union, didn't have trust in the principals, and that the tests were that important to really bring fairness to the evaluation process. You know, and I know that teachers all over the state don't believe that to be true.
Yeah.
But that's kind of been what was the nature of New York City. And I just wanted to say, you know, there's amazing educators in New York City that have been trying their hardest to help, you know, help this movement, because they know that these tests and test prep is taking up way too much time in the classroom and that it doesn't belong there.
Jeanette, it sounded like you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, there's a lot of fear in New York City, and justifiably so. You know, the teachers here on Long Island and the rest of suburbia in New York State have local unions that fully support opt-out. They will stand behind the teachers. The teachers feel a lot safer advocating for parents to make this decision on behalf of their kids. In New York City, teachers have expressed to us that since their local union, the UFT, does not support opt-out, that they, you know, feel a lot of fear that they cannot speak out and they cannot, you know, advocate for this because they don't feel that they'd be backed up on that. So that fear has a real definite impact on the numbers. And you know, Lisa mentioned about the admissions to middle school and high school.
Right.
And although that's the prevailing thought, is that if I don't take those 3-8 tests, I will not be accepted into my middle or high school. But New York City opt-out has done a lot of work with looking into which schools this would cause an issue with and which schools it would not. And so far, they've been unable to identify any schools that have truly, you know, not looked at any student. Usually they will look at portfolios and they will look at other measures. And when we did that forum in New York City the other night, there was a number of parents in the audience that do opt out, and they all raised their hand and said, we got into our first choice, our second choice. So even without scores, they are still able. But when you have that sort of prevailing fear and thought that it's a possibility or it's a potential, or even if the school's information on their, you know, website still kind of have that peace there, you know, it's that the fear of the unknown is very, very strong. And it's exactly why schools will also be afraid of this list. No one knows quite how the calculations work. It's all very mysterious. And that fear that we don't know, but we could, this could happen, has created a real issue. But New York City parents, and that's why we support this legislation, because I'm always the first one to say it is not fair that I get to walk into my school, hand my principal a letter, and that says my kid's opting out, and nothing, and everything's fine. Like, there is no backlash,
right.
There's no, you know, nobody tries to argue against it or tell me that I have to have a meeting now. Whereas New York City parents, it is so much more difficult, and that's not right.
Right.
That is absolutely not right.
Well, we have a few people who have a couple of questions, so let's go ahead and open up those phone lines now. Hi, this is Carol Burris. You're on the air. Can you tell us who you are and where you're calling from?
Yes, it's Kamala, and I'm calling from Brooklyn.
Hi, Kamala. And what's your question?
So I wanted to correct one thing that I heard, which maybe Jeanette was in the middle of correcting. I don't know when I was calling. She was just getting to that point, which is that that the idea that you need test scores for admissions in New York City middle and high school is a misconception, a misperception, that no one tries to really disabuse people of. But actually, if you look in the fine print, schools are supposed to have a rubric that has a workaround for students who don't have scores, because, of course, not only students who refuse the test might not have scores, there could be kids coming from out of state,
right,
private schools, homeschools, et cetera. So there absolutely should be ways. What most places do is they will double weight grades or double weight attendance. Of course, all of these things are ultimately inequitable, which is why the movements to integrate schools are asking for schools to be de-screened, period. And I
right.
don't think it's a coincidence that in New York City, District 15, which is the center of opt-out in New York City, is the one district that so far has implemented a successful desegregation plan that takes away screens, because parents there have already begun to see that we really don't need these tests to sort children for our schools.
I'm so glad that you called in and, you know, and you gave that perspective, because I think it's important for our listeners in the city to know that. So I'm wondering, do you have any personal experience with it, that you opted out and everything turned out okay?
Yes, I do, although in my particular case, my child was already in a school that's a 6 through 12 school, so we didn't have to apply for high school. But I know many people who are in this situation. Every year on the NYC opt-out page, somebody posts a question about this, and you know, a lot of people will post in saying my kid got into X school, next school, next school, next school, and they didn't have these. But there are rubrics which are posted. And but I do want to make that connection though between equity and testing, because the other thing that's happening with these lists is schools that are put on these lists, they are never schools in affluent districts. They are only schools in districts that are high need.
Right.
And as long as we allow the state to continue ranking our schools based on the needs of the student populations, that's just horribly inequitable, and it shouldn't be allowed to happen.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question. This is Carol Burris. This is Talk Out of School. Looks like we lost our caller. I'd like to just maybe end the show with asking both of you to once talk about you know, what is the title of your new book? How can folks get that book? And also, if you can give us some information about a website where they can get more information about opt-out.
Okay, great. Yeah, the book is called, Opting Out, the Story of the Parents Grassroots Movement to Achieve Whole Child Public Schools. It was written by five of us, a professor from Rochester, New York, David Hirsch, Jeanette, myself, Zay Chen, and Zara McGinnis, who were graduate students under David Hirsch and have done amazing work in helping us pull the book together. And you can buy the book at Myers Publishing. And our website as well has a lot of information about opting out, which is nysape.org. And I just wanted to add for 2 seconds on one of the pieces of information that was a big part of the movement, too, was the privacy issue, data privacy. And one of the items that we talked about in 2013 that would invalidate the test and not get us on list, so to speak, would be if students in the whole state, if there were about 10% of all eligible students taking the test, if 10% opted out, and to get 20% relatively over the last 5 years, pretty much stayed steady, is quite amazing. So just wanted to share that.
Well, thank you very much. And I'd like to just tell our listeners, if you like the show, don't forget to sign up online as a BAI buddy for Talk Out of School. And thanks for listening. And thank you so much, Jeanette and Lisa. You promise me you'll come back when we get closer to the tests?
Absolutely.
To it. Wonderful, wonderful. Next week, Lainey will be back as a host right here on WBAI-FM at 10 a.m. on Wednesdays, where we always talk out of school.
Up in the morning and out to school. The teachers are teaching the golden rule. American history and practical math. Study the heart and hope in the past. Working your fingers right down to the bone. And the guy behind you won't leave you alone. Ring, ring, goes the bell. The tuck of my lunch is ready to sell. You're lucky if you can find a seat. You're fortunate if you have time.